From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
A young man shot by police in Ferguson, Missouri overnight was in critical condition at a nearby hospital.
The young man shot by police was identified by his father as 18-year-old Tyrone Harris Jr. of St. Louis, who, his father said, was close with Michael Brown. The elder Harris added that his son was out of surgery early Monday. According to the head of the St. Louis County Police, John Belmar, a man who opened fire on plainclothes police detectives Sunday evening was then pursued and shot by officers. Belmar did not identify the suspect, but said he was in critical condition in the hospital undergoing surgery. Police alleged that the suspect approached detectives who were sitting in a van and opened fire with a 9mm handgun that they said had been stolen last year. Belmar said that the suspect had been tracked throughout the protest because police believed he was armed. On Monday, there were reports of arrests all day long in Ferguson and the surrounding area, which continued until press time. DeRay McKesson is an activist who maintains the website WeTheProtesters.org. He spoke with RT Monday about the claims and facts of violence in Ferguson, the government response thus far to the growing protests, and what organizers say must happen next.
Remember, the only violent people since August have been the police. They've killed 8 people here and paralyzed 1 other person since August. What we've seen is that the police are killing people at record numbers. There have only been 9 days in America in 2015 where the police haven't killed someone. And as of today, they've killed 700 people. So there are a lot of questions that remain. We've exposed the terror of police violence in the last year. And now in the next year, we will work to end it. There's a spotlight on policing and a willingness to critique the police and sort of ask tough questions and challenge their narratives that simply did not exist a year ago. A year ago, people were still believed that Ferguson had a problem. They had not yet understood that in America there's a problem with policing. And now that questioning, that inquisitive spirit, that ability to question is just there now in a way that's really powerful. Some small cases of progress, very small, with like body cameras and some oversight committees being instituted in some cities. But the police have probably been the least responsive since the movement began. They have not owned the fact that they're killing people who should not have been killed. And they have been the most disappointing part of the last year, their unwillingness to acknowledge that they need to grow as an institution and as a government agency. Police have killed 8 people since August and paralyzed 1, and I will not forget that today or tomorrow.
Here in New York, police arrested dozens during a protest marking the first anniversary of Michael Brown's killing. Caleb Maupin was there and filed this report.
The protesters assembled at Barclays Center to commemorate the death of Michael Brown and denounce police brutality against African Americans. Kalisa Moore of the People's Power Assembly hailed the people of Ferguson, Missouri for their rebellion, which made headlines around the world and inspired protests across the country.
We call this action today for Michael Brown, to remember Michael Brown, but also to bring awareness and to acknowledge the impact that the Ferguson community has had on each and every one of us.
Kiana Taylor, a high school student who joined the demonstration, says police brutality is part of everyday life for black youth in the United States.
Police appearances everywhere I see, everywhere I go. It's heavily inside the schools as well. We see nothing but police officers. We have to go through metal detectors, put our badges through metal scanners so they can peek inside. And it's just like, before we even grow up and experience the world, we're already criminalized just by going to high school.
As the protesters marched into the streets, they were followed by the Strategic Response Unit of the New York City Police Department. Several protesters were grabbed from the crowd and arrested following tense confrontations between the crowd and the police. The protesters denounced the court system for not holding officers accountable as the number of people killed continues to rise.
Before that was Eric Garner. After that was Akai Gurley, Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, and the names go on and on and on and on.
The protesters described themselves as part of a nationwide movement demanding an end to police brutality. Demonstrations commemorating Michael Brown took place throughout the city as the day went on. Caleb Maupin, New York.
As Turkey and the U.S. announced a joint plan in recent weeks to engage ISIL in Syria, after months of reports that Ankara was actually aiding and abetting ISIL forces fighting the government in Damascus, there were signs that the war may be coming home to Turkey with a pair of separate attacks in Istanbul Monday, one a sniper attack at the U.S. consulate and the other a bombing of a police station, and yet another attack in the southeast of the country, those being the latest in a series of attacks over the past weeks. In the first attack Monday, two shooters reportedly opened fire outside the U.S. consulate in Istanbul. One of the assailants reportedly fled the scene after security staff shot back, while reports said that the other had barricaded herself in a house, which police then surrounded. One unidentified person was taken from the scene by ambulance following the shooting, although reports on casualties were unclear. In a separate incident, an Istanbul police station was targeted in a bomb blast, injuring at least 10, seven of whom were police officers. The attack in the southeast of the country also targeted police. Inside Turkey, analysts and government officials blamed the attacks on PKK fighters, as Press TV's Rashan Sigler reported from Istanbul Monday.
We've been witnessing a lot of attacks recently. The attacks that are taking place are usually blamed by analysts and by politicians on the government's attack against PKK. And we've been witnessing 3 years in Turkey of peace between the PKK and the government. However, after the recent attacks of the Turkish army on PKK positions in Syria and Iraq, they are saying that the PKK are responsible for the two attacks. Up till now, we don't know. However, one of the attackers on the U.S. consulate was arrested by the Turkish police. She got injured when the police answered to the fires of the attackers, and she was hiding in one of the buildings near the consulate when the police found her. And the police said that investigations are underway and they are going to see who is responsible for this attack. Now, we also don't know who is responsible for the attack of the Sultan Beyli that took place earlier this morning at 12:45 a.m. And it was a bomb attack that targeted a police station. But usually those attacks are blamed on the PKK by the government. And the government always blames the PKK for such attacks. And the PKK sometimes hold responsibility for those attacks. Now, what is happening in the country also, not only in Istanbul, also another attack took place today, which led to the killing of four officers, police officers, and the wounding of another fifth one in southeast of the country. Those series of attacks are taking place for the past 3 weeks in Turkey and led to the killing of more than 50 people so far. Now, the government is trying to secure certain areas in Istanbul and Ankara. We heard that the most of the embassies have been secured and a siege was held in front of the embassies and police stations in Turkey. The police is searching the metro stations for to check if there was any bomb placed there, and they are saying that such attacks might also increase, and they are afraid that those attacks might increase, unfortunately, in Istanbul in particular.
Political analyst Eric Dreitzer said he's not surprised that the fighting has come home to roost in Turkey.
It shouldn't really come as any surprise that these recent terror attacks have hit Turkey and hit it hard in its major city in Istanbul and in other parts of the country, because quite frankly, this is the very predictable blowback from Turkey's policy of fomenting terrorism and of its opportunistic policy of trying to take advantage and capitalize on the quote-unquote war against ISIL by essentially expanding that war against the Kurdish Workers Party, the PKK. And so these recent attacks, if they are to be believed that they are that the responsibility lies with the PKK, it should be seen as retribution for Turkey's aggression against the PKK elements, both the Turkish on the Turkish side of the border and the Kurdish elements on the Syrian side of the border as well. But it should also be remembered that Turkey has been fundamental and a principal player in fomenting ISIS itself and the many other terror groups that have been waging war against the Assad government in Syria. And so whether or not the responsibility for these particular attacks is PKK or is ISIS or is another group, it's part of the broader strategy that Turkey has employed in using terrorism as a weapon of war of its own geopolitical agenda against Syria and in the region.
And isn't that the same game that the United States has been playing, and do the same risks come with that?
Well, that's exactly right. Now, of course, the risk for Turkey is decidedly bigger simply because of its proximity, being on the other side of the border from Syria, these longstanding tensions with the Kurds and all of these other issues. But absolutely, it is part and parcel of what the U.S. is doing vis-a-vis the agenda and the strategy in Syria. And so really, the United States needs to really take a lesson from all of this and understand that there is indeed a price to be paid for fomenting war in Syria, for essentially trying to stand beside Erdogan and his neo-Ottoman strategy for the region and using terrorism as a weapon of war. And see, this is precisely the point that many of us have been making for quite a long time now, that terrorism is not something that the United States and its NATO allies are fighting against. Terrorism is something that they use for their own political advantage. We saw this in Libya, and we've seen the predictable consequences, the collapse of that state, the transformation of a once functioning and quite well-developed country into a failed state. We see something very similar now in the Middle East as the United States and Turkey and Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and all of these other countries have been instrumental in injecting terrorism and radical extremist forces into the region in order to essentially do their dirty work. And quite frankly, this is now part of the legacy of the Obama administration. We understand that as we look back at it historically, that the Obama administration, one of the central tenets of the Obama strategy was, unlike Bush and the neocons, not outright invasion with hundreds of thousands of troops, but rather using terrorism in order to achieve the very same imperialist objectives.
Meanwhile, after being engaged in fighting against ISIL for months, the PKK fighters are now getting it from all sides, including from the Kurds in Iraq, as Press TV's Waqar Rizvi reports.
A senior commander of the Iraqi Kurdish Peshmerga forces has called on the Kurdistan Workers' Party militants to leave Iraq's Kurdistan region. Zaim Ali, the commander of Peshmerga forces stationed in the west of Iraq's semi-autonomous Kurdistan region, said that the presence of PKK forces in the country's north is not legitimate. Ali blamed the PKK for the recent unrest in Turkey's border region. He also added that civilians are paying the price for the animosity between the PKK and Turkish government. The call comes a week after the president of the semi-autonomous Kurdistan regional government, Masoud Barzani, asked PKK militants to leave their stronghold in the Kandil Mountains in north Iraq. According to Barzani, the PKK must keep its battlefield away from the Kurdistan region to avoid civilian casualties.
Israel's settlement expansion and the climate of impunity for Jewish settlers are the root cause of the escalating violence in the occupied Palestinian territory. That, according to a UN special committee, which examined the human rights situation in the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip. The committee recently concluded its annual fact-finding mission, with members meeting with civil society groups and Palestinian officials in Amman, Jordan. Deanne Penn reports.
In a statement on Monday, the UN Special Committee reported that it had been briefed on legislative measures that either were adopted or are under discussion in Israel. This included a bill to allow force-feeding of prisoners on a hunger strike. Civil society groups also expressed alarm over the escalating violence in the occupied Palestinian territory. They cited the deaths of a toddler and his father stemming from the firebombing of their home in late July. It was apparent from the testimonies that the root cause of the escalating violence is the continuing policy of settlement expansion and the climate of impunity relating to the activities of the settlers, according to the statement. The UN Special Committee to Investigate Israeli Practices Affecting the Human Rights of the Palestinian People and Other Arabs of the Occupied Territories will submit a report to the UN General Assembly in November. Deanne Penn, United Nations.
Meanwhile, students and teachers in Gaza say they are counting on UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon to help keep their schools open and solve the current funding crisis. The UN agency that works with Palestinian refugees recently announced it would delay opening its schools in the region for the first time if it fails to raise more than $100 million. On Monday, the Secretary General spoke via Skype with a teacher and with students whose education is threatened by the lack of funds. Stephanie Kutrix filed this report from the United Nations.
In the following extract from the conversation, Ban Ki-moon is speaking with Rua Nasser Abdullah Kedai, an 11-year-old Palestinian refugee whose school was severely destroyed during a 50-day conflict between Israel and Palestine 1 year ago.
And Rua, how important is your education in achieving your dreams?
It enables me to look at the future and achieve my potential.
The UN chief also asked the UNRWA teacher what message he can convey to the international community about their situation. Following the call, I spoke with Ghufran Jalboot and began by asking her what was discussed with the Secretary General.
We're talking about the current issue and the current dilemma about the funding and the decision that maybe is taken about the schools.
So what did Ban Ki-moon tell you?
Promising us that he will talk to the leaders, to the donors, and to the national community to help us, that he is supporting us and he's gonna solve this problem.
What did it mean to the students to be able to speak directly to the UN Secretary General?
This gives them a great support and a great interest. They feel much better that he's so interested and he's supporting them. And they're not alone in this world.
Now, Ms. Jalboot, you're a Palestinian refugee from Syria. Where did you go to school as a child?
I went to UNRWA school for 9 years in Damascus.
And how would you say things have changed since that time?
Schools tend to better, better education. It provides more services and more safe place for the children. So our children nowadays grow safely in the UNRWA schools.
But this is now put into jeopardy. Would you say that that's the situation?
Children now are so afraid that we'll not follow schools in the time because of the funding issue.
Now, when you go back to your classroom and speak with your students, what will you be sharing with them about today's event, speaking with the Secretary General?
I will tell my children, my students, that he was so interested and he's supporting us, and they can count on him because he's going to save their future.
Do you think that your students are hopeful that funding will come in and that you will get help for the schools?
We hope so because he can do it. Count on him to solve this dilemma.
That was UNRWA teacher Ghufran Jalboot about her conversation with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. Stephanie Kutrix, United Nations.
Sunday was the 70th anniversary of the dropping of the second and thus far last nuclear bomb on a human population center, that being the city of Nagasaki, Japan, population 260,000. On Thursday, August 9th, 1945. Within seconds after the detonation, at 11:02 a.m. local time, more than 40,000 people were dead, and, like the initial survivors of the bomb in Hiroshima 3 days before, tens of thousands more people would die painful deaths within the month. The twin nuclear attacks on Japan sparked an arms race, whose legacy 70 years later is a world armed with enough of these weapons to render our species extinct and our planet dead and uninhabitable for centuries. The first international attempt to control nuclear weapons was in 1963, when the U.S., U.K., and Soviet Union signed the first Test Ban Treaty, then known as the Partial Test Ban Treaty, or PTBT, because although it outlawed nuclear weapons tests in the atmosphere, underwater, and in outer space, permitted testing underground and thus enabled further weapons development. A major step towards non-proliferation of nuclear weapons came with the signing of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or NPT, in 1968. Under the NPT, non-nuclear weapons states were prohibited from, among other things, processing, manufacturing, or acquiring nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices. All signatories, including nuclear weapons states, were committed to the goal of total nuclear disarmament.
Little progress was made in nuclear disarmament until the end of the Cold War in 1991, when parties to the PTBT held a conference to discuss extending the treaty to ban all nuclear weapons tests. With strong support from the UN General Assembly, negotiations began in 1993, and after 3 years of wrangling, on September 10, 1996, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, or CTBT, was adopted by a vote of 158-3 with 5 abstentions. To date, 183 states have signed the CTBT, and 163 have ratified it. Although the U.S. signed the treaty, it has not yet been ratified by the U.S. Senate. Dr. Lucina Zerbo is the executive secretary of the UN's Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty Organization. He was in Japan this past weekend to attend ceremonies marking the anniversary of the nuclear attacks on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and spoke with one of the survivors.
I met half an hour ago one of the survivors, and then I told him, I say, what message can I carry for him? And it was simple, short, and sweet. He said, let's work together for international peace. That was his message. He was 17 when Hiroshima was bombed, and he's on a wheelchair today, but he still thinks that this should never happen. No more Hiroshima, no more Nagasaki. Let's work together for peace and stability.
Dr. Zerbo stressed the importance of implementing the CTBT to ensure that the world sees no more Hiroshimas or Nagasakis.
We haven't answered the call of the survivors of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to rid the world from nuclear weapons. But we can't rid the world of nuclear weapons if we don't focus on the entry into force of the CTBT. And this is a message that I want to carry. And this is a message how we can link testing and nuclear weapons. You can only get weapons if you do testing. When I talk about weapon that works, you have to test them. The Ibakushas have been asking the international community for 70 years that what they suffered, they want no one else to suffer the same. We haven't answered a call with regard to nuclear weapons, but there's an easy step to go towards that call, is what the international community has erected as a structure to combat disarmament and non-proliferation. That structure seems to go like a failure today if we take the NPT. But we can emerge from the ashes of many of our shortfalls to move forward with regard to getting success and success. And the recent deal with Iran and the 5+1 talks is one way and one momentum that we should follow. And that will give us more hope, a slight hope, to move where our dream remains, which is a world free of nuclear weapons, hopefully in our lifetime.
This past Thursday, Lily Daigle, the U.S. field organizer for Global Zero, discussed the current movement in the U.S. against nuclear weapons with Liberation Radio's Eugene Puryear.
The atomic bombings of both Hiroshima and Nagasaki were some of the most devastating humanitarian tragedies I think the world has ever seen. Hundreds of thousands of people died in just a matter of seconds because of these weapons of mass destruction, and generations of Japanese have faced some lingering effects from all of the radiation as well.
I'm curious, from your perspective as someone who does this work and talks to a lot of people around the country, do you feel as Americans we have a special responsibility from the point of view of the issue of denuclearization by virtue of where we happen to live?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the United States and Russia have 95% of the world's nuclear arsenals. So I do think that as Americans, it's kind of our duty as citizens to kind of speak out against this moral and humanitarian injustice and work to build as much grassroots power as we can in our communities to convince decision makers like President Obama that they need to take decisive steps towards reducing and eventually eliminating the global stockpile of nuclear weapons.
The history of the U.S. nuclear attacks that's taught in the U.S. is a whitewash that paints the murder of hundreds of thousands of Japanese civilians as a necessary act taken to protect American lives. So says Black Agenda Radio's Bruce Dixon in this commentary.
If you grew up in the U.S., you learned in school that President Truman, near the end of World War II, was forced by the diehard Japanese government to nuke the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki to prevent a seaborne U.S. invasion that might have cost hundreds of thousands of Americans and millions of Japanese lives. Like many things we learned in school, this is a complete fabrication. As a U.S. senator, Harry Truman had declared that the U.S. should help the Nazis if the Soviets were winning, and the Soviets if the Nazis were winning, so as to kill as many of both as possible. The Soviets faced more than 80% of the Nazi armies in World War II and suffered more than 20 million dead, absorbing and rolling back the Nazi invasion forces all the way to Berlin. Despite early assurances, the U.S. and Britain delayed entering the land war against Nazi Germany from 1942 to 43 and finally to the summer of 1944. By the summer of 1945, the U.S. had sunk the Japanese Navy, defeated its isolated forces from the Philippines to Okinawa, blockaded Japan into near starvation, and bombed most of its wooden cities to burnt matchsticks. U.S. officials were pointedly ignoring Japanese surrender overtures. The Japanese wanted badly to surrender before the Soviet Red Armies could invade their Chinese and Korean colonies, where the bulk of their intact forces still were. But the eyes of U.S. policymakers were fixed upon the next war and the next enemy, the Soviet Union. The U.S. bombed the undefended cities of Hiroshima on August 6th and Nagasaki on August 9th, not to end the war with Japan, but in the hopes of intimidating the Soviet Union, which that same week rolled up most Japanese forces in China and Korea. So the atomic bombing of Japanese cities and the fiery immolation of hundreds of thousands of Japanese civilians and the slow killing of an equal number over the next few decades from radiation was not even about Japan. It was U.S. imperial bluster to set the stage for more than 40 years of the Cold War against the Soviet Union and eventually China as well, to establish the U.S. as the sole and only global superpower. It didn't work. The Soviets tested their own nukes in 4 years, and a global arms race was on. In the late 1980s, before the fall of the USSR, its leaders proposed major mutual cutbacks of all nuclear weapons, but President Reagan said no. The Russian state that succeeded the Soviet Union was assured at birth that the U.S. and its Eurasian military arm NATO would never threaten Russia, but that was almost immediately proven a lie. President Obama early in his first term made hopeful noises about curtailing nuclear weapons, but was careful not to move on this intention until the Congress was safely in the hands of Republicans. Under President Obama, NATO bases, some with nuclear arms, now ring the western and southern rims of Russia. The U.S. funded the overthrow of the Ukrainian government. U.S. warships are now in the Black Sea, and America has long forsaken its commitments to nuclear nonproliferation, disarmament, and peace with Russia. Nuclear-armed U.S. aircraft carriers are parked in the Philippines and Southeast Asia, allegedly to deter Chinese expansion. President Obama inherited a blood-stained, radioactive, murderous legacy on nuclear weapons and managed to make it all a little bit worse than he found it. Not bad for a Nobel Peace Prize winner whose acceptance speech justified preventive war. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Bruce Dixon.
How long can we go on? How long can we go on? This troubled land may never last. The times of war are in the past. How far have we gone? How far have we gone? So many battles without a game.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.